This evening I want to talk about how I came to have an interest in and experience of self-compassion, self-forgiveness, and gratitude in my own life, and why I think that the heart practices are a necessary complement to mindfulness practice, and how to make those practices relevant in our particular lives. And last but not least, I wanted to talk just a little bit about why I think that those practices are so important in today's world. A feeling of unworthiness, deep shame, and guilt came from my collective German as well as my personal family history. I remember the day of being 12, 13 years old and learning about the atrocities my people committed to Jews, gays, and many others. With that knowledge, my childhood ended abruptly. Images of mountains of glasses that belonged to people that had died in the gas chambers, of children behind barbed-wired fences, haunted me. I was ashamed of being a German, to be part of a society with awful secrets, which were now covered up by materialism and a post-war economic boom. I was just thinking how some of it in the air feels similar. This painful history felt like a heavy stone on my heart, leaving me with a deep existential sense of meaninglessness. I knew this feeling of shame and self-reproach also from feeling like the outsider in my family, the awkward one, the one without a father. Given our family's very strict Catholic beliefs, my mother, upon learning that she was pregnant, had hidden me in an orphanage for the first 2 years of my life. She tried to keep my birth secret and then to tell her family that I was adopted. I felt tormented by the feeling of not being able to undo this awful history, by not being able to save my mother, who was in a lot of pain, and by not being able to untangle these feelings of disgrace. In 1980, after 2 car accidents and 2 months in hospital, I took a break from university. I was then in medical school in Germany and traveled with my boyfriend to Sri Lanka. He was an India traveler and took me under his wings. And there I had an unexpected encounter. We went there really to study acupuncture. That was kind of our excuse for our parents to travel to Asia. And one day, I remember it was monsoon in Colombo. I was walking by myself down the street and I saw this little International Buddhist Center Road, and just I was curious. I didn't know anything about it, so I went down this little street, and there was it, the International Buddhist Center. And I rang the bell, really not knowing what would happen. And a young monk opened the door and said, "What do you want?" And I said, "I don't know." And he said, "That is very good. Follow me." And so I followed him, and now looking back, I wasn't even dressed appropriately. And we went up and down in this very large monastery, as it turned out, into the basement, which was really the only cooled place in Sri Lanka, downstairs in the basement. And there were a lot of old monks sitting there, very ancient-looking monks. And he had me sit down in front of the most ancient-seeming monk. He looked just like a little mummy there. And so I sat down, and I really was curious. And then this monk looked at me, and it seemed kind of, he looked right straight through me. And he said, "What do you want?" And I said again, "I don't know." And he said, "Oh, that is very good." And then I said, "I want to learn." And then he said, "Okay, come back every morning at 9:15. And so that's what I did. I went there every morning at 9:15. And later from Jack Kornfield, I found out that it was actually quite a famous monk. Dhammaloka was his name. He was the head monk in Sri Lanka. And I don't know what he said, but it was somehow a very meaningful encounter for me. And so when I looked into the eyes of this ancient wise monk, I glimpsed for the first time the spaciousness and lucidity of liberation, which felt to me like a refuge from this torturous inner place I had been in. Sitting in front of him so unexpectedly, without knowing anything about Buddhism really, gave me this deep sense of longing, longing for a wholeness that I had been missing in my life. And so I was hooked at that moment, and I kind of just knew I would never let go of that again. And even though practice in the Sri Lankan monastery was excruciatingly hard, they had us sit really for very long hours all day long, I had finally found a safe place, a refuge inside. So some years into my meditation practice, however, I realized that my propensity for self-criticism, as well as for feelings of deficiency and guilt, sabotaged my learning. And I was wondering, did ever anybody have those kinds of feelings? Yeah. I was experiencing my mind as unmanageable and was blaming myself for this. It felt like it was kind of this war between my mind and myself. And I was feeling that I was falling short from what I thought would be a good practitioner. I continuously bumped up against what I call lerps. Let me explain what I mean by that. Lerps, as I call them, long-standing, recurrent, painful patterns, inner formations, which many of us carry around since childhood. Actually, the word lerps came from a discussion I had with Jack Kornfield. We talked about complexes, and he said, "Radley, find a new word. This is an ancient word." And so I came up with lerps, and then he said, "This is too long. Long-standing, recurrent, painful pattern." But I guess lerps kind of fits. You can even say, "I got lerped." So for me, these mental and emotional patterns surrounded themes of unworthiness, abandonment, and fear, and they felt ancient to me. So in those years, sitting Vipassana, I began to realize that I needed an additional kind of practice to work with my unquiet mind and aching heart. Therapy helped, lots of therapy, but I longed for meditation practices that would assist me in quieting this inner conflict. I also sensed that it would be helpful to find a bridge between the work I was doing in therapy and my meditation practice. So in the late 80s, I came across Sharon Salzberg's book of loving kindness. Did it come in the mid or late 80s? Maybe around 85? Yeah. And even though I liked metta practices, they felt at times too formulaic to me. On the one hand, they were very simple, For example, may I be happy, may I be safe, may I be free. Yet often their simplicity didn't touch my core. I needed them to be more relevant to my own predicament. And with the encouragement of Jack Kornfield, and after many years of practice with myself and my clients, by then I was a psychologist, psychotherapist, I began to develop phrases that felt more alive, accessible, and relevant to me, that touched my heart. And so as I began to be able to identify my LERPs, for example, my fear of people, of the potential they raised for criticism and abandonment, along with my dread of failure and the anger I would feel towards those I felt hurt by, I began to formulate constructive, creative, and I tried to find moving phrases for myself and for others, of compassion for myself and for others, of forgiveness for myself and for others, and as well as acceptance and gratitude. So I want to first describe how I understand these terms, given that my old understanding of them was burdened by confusion and resistance. Because I remember, as much as I needed these hard practices, I also felt some resistance towards them. Did anybody feel resistance? Yeah. They felt, for example, when I first encountered loving kindness, it sounded a bit Pollyanna-ish to me. Compassion smacked of pity, forgiveness of condoning and whitewashing wrongdoing, and gratitude made me think of polite goody-two-shoes. They reminded me of writing Christmas thank you cards, dutifully written yet emotionally a bit disconnected. Jack Kornfield taught me a totally new kind of understanding about compassion when he said, and this is a quote, "Compassion arises naturally as the quivering of the heart in the face of pain, ours and another's. When we come to rest in the great heart of compassion, we discover a capacity to bear witness to, suffer with, and hold dear with our own vulnerable hearts, the sorrows and beauties of the world." I really love that definition. So this practice now was not about self-indulgence, but instead about a willingness to feel with ourselves and a readiness to experience our sensations and emotions of hurt with non-judgmental kindness. So for myself, I discovered three steps that worked for me in cultivating self-compassion. So the first step was a gentle understanding of where my difficult emotions came from and how they developed. For example, it helped me to understand that my fear of abandonment came from having spent 2 years in an orphanage. The second step included the felt sense of my experience, such as feeling, for example, the contraction around my heart. I remember when I first started sitting in Sri Lanka, I often just really felt this ache around my heart. And Eugene Gentling called this the felt sense, and he defines it like this. The felt sense is a special kind of internal bodily awareness, a body sense of meaning, which the conscious mind is at first unable to articulate. So the felt sense helped me to recognize when I felt afraid, hurt, angry, or ashamed, and to gain meaning, insight into these experiences. So the depth of this understanding allowed me to access the ability to extend compassion towards myself, which leads to step three. Maitri, a Sanskrit word, means to act with kindness, compassion, and forgiveness towards myself, ourselves, rather than to go to self-blame. This also means treating myself, ourselves, with warmth and a sense of friendship. So one more time, these three steps. The first is recognize with gentle understanding. Second, feel the felt sense. And third, extend compassion to yourself. For a moment, I want to invite you to look inside, to explore your relationship with yourself. Here is what I call a brief self-compassion inventory. The idea is to identify your default attitude on a spectrum between self-blame and self-compassion. I might like to invite you to close your eyes. Feel your breath. Listen deeply and sense your inner landscape. See how the following statements apply to you. And if you feel touched by one or two, notice how your body feels when you receive them. One, do I tend to be gentle towards myself when I feel vulnerable? Or am I easily chastising myself for being weak? Do I in the ground of my being see myself as a good, likable person, or am I feeling that I'm generally flawed and unlikable? Or am I vacillating between the two? Three, do I tend to perceive my difficult experiences as part of the human condition? Or do I understand them as a particular fault of mine? Four, do I see my capacity to feel compassion for myself as connected with my ability to care for another's suffering? Or do I see no connection between the two? As we learn to extend compassion towards ourselves, we will be able to extend compassion towards others and our world. I call this the spiral of compassion. Now you can open your eyes. And I think many of us are vacillating between the two, or we are on a continuum. But it's interesting to just notice. So second, what is forgiveness? Forgiveness is a letting go of past suffering and betrayal, a release of the burden of pain and hate that we carry. Whenever we forgive, we free ourselves from the burden of a painful past and from the burden of self-blame. Without forgiveness, we are forced to carry the sufferings of the past and repeat them on and on and on. So what I really learned, what helped me, is to see that forgiveness is fundamentally for our own sake, for our own mental health. Yet, beyond our self-interest, forgiveness also makes our world a better place. Imagine current politics. It would change everything. As we become increasingly free of resentment, we can move forward to a new engagement with ourselves, with others, and with our world. So, and what is gratitude? With gratitude, we learn to see our glass not as half empty, but as half full. And maybe we even realize that our glass has been full all along, and we just have forgotten it. We might see our life as a tapestry with lot of colored threads. There may be many dark threads as well. An attitude of gratitude means to realize that we have a choice to notice the golden threads, even when there are only very few. If we notice what we already feel love and appreciation for, and we allow ourselves to feel what we are feeling, then we come into the heart space, into interbeing. Gratitude is an emergent phenomenon of the heart. For example, when I realize the love I have for my daughter in the midst of being also aware of the danger of a possible war, and if I allow myself to drop into this feeling of love, then I can become more deeply grounded in my heart. And then this allows me to be more present with all there is. Because remember, in Buddhist philosophy, we say compassion, the near enemy, could be despair. And the antidote is joy. So we do need this balance. With gratitude, meaning with an open heart and loving awareness, we can also learn to experience adversity as a path of learning and meaning-making. And that was a really important step for me, because so often we see adversity as a calamity, as bad luck and misfortune, which it often is. But if we can also see adversity as a teacher, then we can grow and we can develop wisdom. Often we can see this only in hindsight. For example, when I look back at my two serious car accidents from a hard place, I recognize how those seeming misfortunes forced me to make much needed changes. Those adversities catapulted me ultimately into a wonderful psychological and spiritual path. I'm grateful for that. I always say if I hadn't come on this path, I would be now a radiologist in Germany looking at x-rays. So it's much more interesting now. So mindfulness, self-kindness, self-compassion, and self-forgiveness are crucial steps in self-care for all of us. Many of us have been worried in the past year, not only about our personal lives, but also about the social and environmental future of our country, of our world. Many of us have been feeling as if something in the very fabric of our democracy could be unraveling. So lately I came across a really interesting term, moral distrust disorder. It's a fairly new term, originally coming from the nursing literature. Moral distrust disorder shares some aspects with burnout and with compassion fatigue, but it is also different. The word captures what many of us are experiencing. Here's the definition. Moral distrust occurs when an individual identifies an ethically appropriate action, but is prevented by external constraints from acting in accordance with her convictions, and is even expected to act against her moral views. An example from my own friends and clients might be a teacher who has to witness and stand by when the mother of one of her pupils is picked up by ICE. Another example, one would be a nurse or a doctor who's not able to provide medical services to a person without insurance. You probably can think about many other examples. Feelings of frustration, impotence, and isolation often follow, or a person with such awareness may feel devalued or marginalized. When those feelings of moral distress reoccur again and again, a lingering sense of having been compromised, an erosion of one's sense of self-worth may follow. In the larger cultural setting, individuals may feel anxious, confused, discouraged, and even hopeless. So, how can we practice compassion, forgiveness, and gratitude in daily life? First, I want to mention that formal and on-the-go practices of compassion, forgiveness, and gratitude work best when they are set on the solid basis of ongoing daily mindfulness practices. And this might be already redundant to you, but maybe for some people this is new. So mindfulness, seen as moment-to-moment non-judgmental awareness, helps us to find a refuge inside, helps us to turn our gaze inward, and allows us to have increased self-awareness about the process of sensing, feeling, thinking, our pains, and our joys. We learn to catch the moment when our minds are wandering so we can choose to remember, to return to the present moment awareness. We learn to allow these phenomena to pass by without grasping and without pushing them away. And that's basically the second noble truth. You know, suffering comes from attachment, from grasping, and from pushing away, the most subtle of all tasks. We learn kindness and caring for ourselves as we deal with our unwieldy minds and tortured hearts. Because the second noble truth is easier said than done, right? And we learn to experience, to accept our human condition, which we are made that way. So we have to have a lot of compassion for ourselves. Then we can develop practices that are accessible and relevant for our particular situation. So, on the basis of mindful collected awareness, we can now apply phrases that are personally relevant. For example, a friend of mine had a recurrence of breast cancer. She felt very vulnerable, at odds with her own body, which she felt betrayed by. So she liked the following phrases. May I hold myself with tender care. May I offer compassion to myself, especially when I feel vulnerable and wounded in my body. I extend caring for myself when I feel scared and lonely. May I be patient to hold my fear with patience and with warmth. And you know, you can be creative and make your own phrases. Another client of mine felt very angry about his partner who had left him 1 year earlier. He blamed her and himself. The following phrases helped him. May I let go of the resentment I hold towards myself? May I forgive myself for the mistakes I made along the way? May I let go of the resentment I hold towards my ex to this day? Or may I at least hold the intention to do so when I'm ready? To hold the intention to do a desired step forward in the future, it may be a skillful means to hold this intention first on the way of creating a new habit. So you might say, may I, possibly in many years, be able to forgive her, and may I allow myself to start again, new and fresh. And often we recognize that then things happen much quicker than we thought. Another way to bring mindfulness and compassion into the present moment when we need it most is with the help of a mindful pause. When we take a mindful pause, we choose to interrupt a situation during which we have become unbalanced or reactive. This can allow us to find a renewed sense of steadiness. For example, many of my clients tell me how they feel overwhelmed by life these days, at home, at work, in the current social situation. There seems to be increasingly feelings of alienation and fear, and often just one more additional obstacle occurs and we are put into a complete frenzy. Does anybody know this? Yeah, it just seems the ice is a little thinner. So the following practice might be a useful mindful pause, which integrates mindfulness, body awareness, self-compassion, and an experience of interbeingness. Again, I will guide you through a brief reflection. Close your eyes and remember a time, maybe recently, when you felt overwhelmed by life. Remember the environment, who was around, the atmosphere, the light in the room. First, notice your body. Second, exhale gently to relax. Three, feel your pain and overwhelm concerning the situation you are in. Four, sense the breath of your heart. Five, pause to give compassion to yourself and feel with your own suffering. You might even want to put a hand on your heart or belly. Six, linger with the felt sense of that pain while allowing breath to connect you to wider perspective. Seven, when ready, return to life. And please open your eyes again. Now I want to just briefly break down why I chose those phrases. Noticing the body brings us into the felt sense, the present moment, where we are neither in the past nor the future. We are in the now. Exhale gently to relax. It's about activating the vagal tone, like Howard Benson called it, the relaxation response, which comes with the exhale. Feel your pain and overwhelm concerning the situation. Recognizing what is happening takes our experience of discomfort a notch down. Sense the breath of your heart. The heart is a place of great sensitivity. You might have heard about the HeartMath Institute. It's an organ of perceiving intuition. And some mystics called the heart the organ of psycho-spiritual perception. Pause to give compassion to yourself. Self-compassion, and I think there are a bunch of studies, but also I noticed that in my office, seeing 30 clients a week. I hear it again and again. Self-compassion allows anxiety to go down, to feel more relaxed and grounded, and to feel less alone. Linger with the felt sense while allowing the breath to connect us to wider perspective. Connecting to this wider perspective, a sense of interbeing, decreases our fear and allows us, as Mary Oliver calls it, to be connected to the family of things. When ready, return to life. It is important to notice when time has come to step out again and to reconnect. So I want to end this talk by teaching you a very brief gratitude reflection. One of my teacher's friend is the Buddhist teacher and social activist Joanna Macy. Does some of you know her? She's a wonderful teacher. And she asks us to remember something about being alive in this world at this time we are truly grateful for. Gratitude allows us to be present to feel the suffering with the world without getting overwhelmed. And then we can go forth and be engaged for the welfare of all. And one last time, close your eyes. And remember something in your life or life in general. You feel grief and sadness about. Bring an image to mind. Remember the atmosphere. First, notice your body. Second, exhale very gently to relax. Three, Recognize your feelings of grief or sorrow. Four, feel the soft breath of your heart. Five, in a subtle and gentle way, remember something you feel love and tenderness for. This might be a human, a pet, a place, or a plant. Six, feel the felt sense of that memory in your body with breath brushing through ever so gently. Allow for a feeling of open-heartedness, of gratitude for this being to fill your body and mind. Eight, linger there for a while and allow your soul to rest and heal. Nine, allow breath to connect you to the wider flow of life. 10, when ready, reconnect to what lies ahead. And again, find your breath. Notice breath brushing through ever so gently. Connecting inhale and exhale and exhale. With inhale, connecting us all. May all beings be happy. May all beings be safe. May all beings be free. May we become what we need to become to allow this to happen. And may the benefits of this meditation go out into the world and beyond. Open your eyes. And if you're interested in these or other practices, then they're in my book, Heart Work, The Path of Self-Compassion. But in the meantime, I was wondering if you have questions or comments. You have a question? Yes?
I think at intellectual level, you understand compassion and you understand forgiveness, but it's hard to kind of implement. Meditation definitely helps. The loving kindness or metta meditation, is that kind of what allowed you to, yeah, in your practice?
That's a wonderful question, thank you. And I do think it is quite a lengthy practice. I do remember about 15 years ago when I did a 10-day retreat with Jack Kornfield, and he had me do a compassion meditation morning to night. No mindfulness, just compassion. And I just remember when I was brushing my teeth, when I was going to bed, when I was getting up, just compassion, when I was eating. And I remember in the end my heart felt this loose, a little bit aching, but kind of this big thing, you know. It felt almost it had physiologically changed. But I do think at first there's an intention and a longing. Maybe before the intention is a longing. Longing leads to intention, leads to behavior, leads to habits, leads to personality, leads to destiny. So I think there is a longing for our hearts to melt, you know, and then it's a slow process. And it's not necessarily a linear process. But I notice over time, as I keep practicing, and I really kind of had a deep longing to practice this, that it becomes slowly more and more like a spontaneous response. Not always, but more and more often, it becomes part of not even thinking about it. It just happens. Does that make sense? Thank you.
I have a little difficulty delineating between self-forgiveness and self-compassion. And I find that even when something has been done to me, a betrayal or abuse or whatever, I have no problems forgiving the other person. I have a lot of problems forgiving myself for even minor infractions. But I also have a confusion between self-compassion and self-forgiveness and how they connect up.
I would say they are close cousins. And you might even say, you know, they're like two circles kind of overlapping. They're not really two totally different things. They're both hard practices like loving kindness, compassion, forgiveness. You know, they are kind of overlap a little bit. But I think forgiveness has a bit more of a sense of letting go of a grudge, letting go of a resentment. So does that make sense? It's more letting go of a burden that we hold and carry. So I think it just has a little bit of a different flavor, but it's not completely different. And I think self-compassion or compassion for another can then easily make way for forgiveness. So it's kind of segueing into that. Thank you.
This is a bit of a whimsical comment that I have also struggled with the phrase about may I have peace, may I have be safe, and tried rewriting it in language that resonated with me, and I really loved the examples you shared. But it strikes me as almost like a new form of poetry. You know, like there's a standard haiku. It has certain syllables, and it rhymes in a certain way. But instead of number of syllables or rhyming, it's about things that connect back to those the central ideas of being safe and free and happy. But different for each person.
That's great comment, thank you. And I was just actually thinking, wouldn't it be cool if somebody probably much younger than us would make some rap songs with it? You know, it's like to really go creative with it. That would be wonderful. And the main thing is you feel it. You know, that's really what counts. Whatever helps to really have a felt sense of this experience.
Speaking of felt sense, what are some tips that you might have on being able to get in greater touch with the felt sense?
You mean like more psychological texts on this?
No, body felt sense.
Oh, techniques.
Body felt sense, yes.
Oh, yeah. So definitely slowing down. Slowing down and feeling what your body feels like. So bringing attention to, let's say, the contraction in your heart, the knot in your belly, maybe a difference of temperature. Maybe you hold tension in your limbs, a pressure in your head. Those kinds of things would be a felt sense. And the more you notice it, the more it will be, you will be used to recognizing it. It will get easier and easier. I remember my first therapist, still in Germany, 1982, asking me, what do you feel? And I would always say, oh, I think this and this. She said, no, what do you feel? And it took me a long time to recognize that there was a feeling that was different than my thinking. So it's sometimes a gradual process. So thank you very much. Are there more questions? Or otherwise, I wanted to... Oh, there's one more. Okay. Or two more. All right.
Yeah. You shared the story about being with the monks, and they asked you the question of, what do you want? And your answer was, I don't know.
Yeah.
If you were with them today, and they asked you that question again, what would your answer be?
That's a very interesting one. I think, you know, there is, do you know that book by Jack Kornfield, Wise Heart? And he talks about consciousness or awareness being like light, particle and wave. You know, my awareness is, or consciousness is, both moment-to-moment awareness and a field of awareness. And the Dalai Lama, whom I really love, and I go, actually I'm on my way to India, so tomorrow Dublin, where my son is, and the day after, 2 days after, Delhi and Dharamsala, so I'm on my way. So the Dalai Lama talks about the field of benevolence. So I think I would love to, and Joanna Macy talks about paticca samuppada, dependent co-arising. I think my longing would be to really experience being part of everything and feeling that everything is alive. Awareness as field as well as moment-to-moment awareness. And to really feel as myself just arising out of this dependently co-arising field, and to do what I can to contribute. So, yeah, I guess that would be my answer. Thank you. Long-winded, but there it is. Yeah.
What does happiness mean to you?
Happiness. Good one. I think happiness means to me... I might quote one of my teachers, Alan Wallace, maybe you heard of him. He talks about inner happiness, eudaimonia, and hedonia, outer happiness. And I think cultivating more of a sense of inner happiness, one that's not so dependent on outside circumstances, seems really worthwhile to me. Even though I also like to enjoy, I have three kids, so I like to enjoy them and my little dog and nature and my husband, and you know. So, but I think having this quality of inner happiness that is not so dependent on what is happening would really feel valuable to me. Does that answer?
That answers it.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you.